Charles Haddon Spurgeon is considered by many to have been the greatest preacher that ever lived who spoke in the English language. He was a Baptist. He preached during the last century. He's not a contemporary preacher. But for 31 years in his Metropolitan Tabernacle, located in England, maybe that was London, I'm not sure what town, I think it was London, but for 31 years in his Metropolitan Tabernacle, he preached to an average crowd of 5,000 people every Sunday. He could have had many more, but that's all his church would hold. Once a quarter, once every 3 months, he asked everybody in his congregation to stay home on Sunday morning, just so he could see some new faces. And when they all stayed home, he still had 5,000 people in attendance. The story is told of Mr. Spurgeon that on one particular occasion, he was showing some visitors through the Metropolitan Tabernacle, showing them the facilities. When all of a sudden, he stopped and he said, "Come, I want to show you the heating apparatus." Well, they thought that was a little strange, I'm sure. And I'm sure they were floored when he took them into a large room filled with 400 people engaged in prayer. Then they realized what he meant when he said, "I'll show you the heating apparatus." You see, he knew the truth that prayer is basic to success in the church. Even more than that, he knew the truth that prayer is basic to leadership. Leadership will be the focus of our messages for the next few weeks. We need leaders in the church. We need leaders in the homes. We need leaders in business. We need Christian leaders in all of these fields. But to be a good leader, in fact, to be a leader at all, a person has to become a man or a woman of prayer. Prayer is the heating apparatus, you might say. Prayer is that which brings divine power to focus in the personality of an individual who commands authority. Nehemiah was such a man. Nehemiah was a slave. Oh, he held a high position as a slave, that's true, but he was nonetheless a slave, the cupbearer of King Artaxerxes of Persia. A Jew, a descendant of those who had been taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. Then when the Persians, of course, conquered Babylon, he became a subject of the Persians. It was this slave who became the leader of Israel, who saw to it that Jerusalem was restored. Zerubbabel had 63 years earlier left under the decree of King Cyrus of Persia to go back to Jerusalem to build the temple. And then later, about 50 years previous to our first chapter here in Nehemiah, Ezra took back another group and the temple was eventually completed. But the walls and the restoration of the city itself, particularly the walls for its defenses, were not finished. When we come to Nehemiah, Nehemiah began 63 years after Zerubbabel led the first of the captives back. How is it that this slave became such a leader? How is it he secured the permission of the king of Persia, was able to go back and do what no one else had been able to do in Jerusalem for 63 years? It was because he was a leader. And what made him such a leader? He was a man of prayer. In fact, In the book of Nehemiah, you'll find recorded 11 different times that Nehemiah was engaged in prayer. Prayer is basic to leadership. If anyone's going to be a leader, they've got to be a prayer. My friends, we need leaders. We need leaders. Not just leaders by title, but leaders by action. We have teachers, Sunday school teachers. We have deacons. In both cases, you're a leader in the church. We have elected officers. You're leaders. In the family, the husband is the leader, and his partner, the wife, is also a leader in another respect. Many of you in business are leaders. And we all have a testimony to maintain before the world. In that sense, we are leaders. And if we're going to be any kind of leaders at all, we've got to learn to pray. And that's simply the focus of the message this morning in Nehemiah 1:1-10. A good leader is prayerful. A good leader is prayerful. He is a man of prayer. And there's three reasons why this is true that we can find here in Nehemiah chapter 1. The first reason is contained in verses 1-4. A good leader is prayerful because problems are great. Problems are great. They are beyond our resources. They require divine intervention. Look at chapter 1 of Nehemiah, verses 1-3. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hilkiah, "And it came to pass in the month Chislev, in the 20th year, that I was in Shushan the palace." Remember, he was the king's cupbearer, the slave. He was in the palace. "Then Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant who are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire." Now, the breaking down of the walls and the burning of the wooden gates with fire occurred 133 years ago. 63 years ago, you remember Zerubbabel led the first of the captives back, the beginning of the book of Ezra. But 70 years prior to that, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had conquered Judah and destroyed the walls and burnt the gates and took them into captivity. When Zerubbabel and Ezra came, in that return, they restored the temple. And they intended to restore the walls, but that had never happened. If you look back with me in Ezra chapter 4, you remember when we studied the book of Ezra that verses 6 to 23 of chapter 4 of Ezra is a parenthetical section. It is actually looking forward to Nehemiah's day. But it's included in Ezra to make a point, and it fits in with the logic of the book of Ezra, and we're not going to go into all that. But what happened was those people who lived round about Jerusalem, the Samaritans and the Arabs and the Amorites and Edomites, all those people, they did not want to see Jerusalem rebuilt. They did not want to see it prosper. They were enemies. So they got together, and through intrigue, they constructed a whole series of lies and so forth. They sent a letter back to King Artaxerxes, the same king here in Nehemiah's day. But back in Ezra, he's mentioned, it's looking forward, remember. Now, what was Artaxerxes' answer in verse 21 of Ezra 4? He says, "Give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not builded until another commandment shall be given from me." They'd already built the temple at this time. But Artaxerxes says, stop work on the city. Don't do anything. They intended to build the walls, but Artaxerxes says, no, do nothing unless you receive a commandment from me. And here was Nehemiah, the cupbearer of Artaxerxes, faced with the task of trying to change the mind of the king and then trying to get the job done, even off in the future beyond that. It looked absolutely hopeless. Would the king change his mind? The people back in Judah, they were afraid to disobey the king. They had done nothing. The walls were scattered. They were at the mercy of their enemies. They were in great affliction and reproach, as Nehemiah was told. You see, from our standpoint, our problems are insurmountable. Just from Nehemiah's standpoint, there was really nothing that could be done except depend on God to do something. You see, from our standpoint, when things are insurmountable as far as we're concerned, it is then that we realize the importance of prayer. It is often our only recourse. And so that's what Nehemiah does. He engages in prayer in verse 4. And it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept, and mourned certain days, and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. I can't do anything, so I put it before God. It's often when we can do nothing that we are in the most favorable of circumstances, in my opinion. It is when we can do absolutely nothing about our situation that we can find the most peace. Because it is then and only then that we learn to rely totally on God. You see, the way we usually approach things is this. We have a problem, so we make a lot of plans. We figure out what we can do about it and what things we can manipulate and what strings we can pull and how we're going to solve the problem. And then when we get all done, we say, "Oh God, would you please bring this to pass? Would you bless my efforts?" And the trouble with it a lot of times is this. It is our efforts alone. But it is when we realize we have no recourse. The problem is insurmountable, that we can turn wholly unto God and look to Him to change the situation. It is then we are in a most favorable condition, for we get ourselves out of the way and our human efforts that exclude God, and we depend on Him. When people come to me for counseling, I am often faced with what looks to me to be an insurmountable problem. Some of you maybe have been in my office. Several have in the past few years. And when people come to me with their problems, my heart goes out to them because I sit there and I think, what in the world how can we solve this? What in the world can we do? And we look at God's Word and we come up with some answers, but still, it looks so hopeless. And I have watched over the past 6 years as God has changed people's lives. And my friends, I've become more and more convinced over that passage of time that any results that have taken place are more the result of prayer than of my efforts or even of the individual's efforts. I'm convinced of that. Prayer changes things, and a good leader knows where the power is. He knows where the source is. And he has to learn to turn there. A good leader is prayerful, first of all, because problems are great. And now, number two, there's a second reason why a good leader is prayerful. And that is quite simply this, because man is sinful. Because he realizes and he knows and recognizes that men are sinners. You see, sin is most often the root cause of our problems. Nehemiah recognized this as he begins to pray in verses 5 and 6. And said, "I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awe-inspiring God, who keepeth covenant and mercy for them who love him and observe his commandments. Let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now, day and night, for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Both I and my father's house have sinned." Now Nehemiah in his mind goes back the 63 years before Zerubbabel returned at all to Jerusalem, back the 70 years of the captivity, back before Nebuchadnezzar came and took Judah captive, back to the days when his forefathers sinned against God, which brought about this divine judgment. Nehemiah recognizes that the root cause of the problem is the sin of God's people. Three times he mentions their sin, and he includes himself. You say, well, what in the world did Nehemiah do? That was his forefathers. He wasn't even born. But he takes it upon himself to confess the sins of his nation. He realizes the root cause. And when you realize the root cause of sin, then we understand that confession is a means of dealing with our problems. And that's exactly what Nehemiah does in verse 7. He's admitted the sin and now he confesses what it is. In verse 7, we have dealt very corruptly against thee and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances, which thou commandest thy servant Moses. He said, we have disobeyed. I admit this. That's what confession is. It's an admission that God is right in what he has done, because what he says is sin, and we're involved in it. That is confession. Confession is often our only means of dealing with a problem. And it is that case whenever our problem is the result of sin. A leader has to recognize that. A leader has to realize that he is a sinner and that he is dealing with sinners, and that sin must be dealt with before anything can be accomplished. Abraham Lincoln is famous for the Gettysburg Address. But in my opinion, Abraham Lincoln gave another address that was its equal. In fact, my much more important address. It was on the occasion of his proclaiming of April 30th, 1863 as a national day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer. In that message, he says this, and I quote, "The awful calamity of civil war which now desolates the land may be but a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuous sins to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity, too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness." You see, Abraham Lincoln, the great leader that he was, realized what the root cause of all problems were. He recognized man's sinfulness, and he recognized that the only way that man's sinfulness can be dealt with is through confession. Such is the case for a leader. A leader must confess sins. He must be concerned with sins, and therefore he must be a prayerful individual. A good leader is a person of prayer. He is prayerful because problems are too great for he alone or for any man, and because of man's sin, which necessitates prayer. There's a third reason as well. A good leader must be prayerful because it is God that is in control. A leader must never forget that it is not he that is accomplishing anything, but that it is God who is responsible for anything that takes place. It is God that is in control. Look at verses 8 and 9. Nehemiah continues in his prayer. He says, "Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if ye transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the peoples. But if ye turn unto me, and keep my commandments, and do them, though there were of you cast out into the uttermost part of the heaven, yet will I gather them from there and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name." Nehemiah here is summarizing some Old Testament verses, particularly so Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 to 5. It's not a direct quote, but he refers to them. And the thing that he brings up to God when he says, "Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest," is this: God's faithfulness. You see, he realized that God's actions are always based on his faithfulness to his word. God had said that if you disobey, I will scatter you abroad among the people. They disobeyed, they went into captivity. But notice as well that there in verse 9 that Nehemiah says this, in quoting that Old Testament passage or in referring to it. He says, "But if ye turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out on the uttermost part of the heaven, yet will I gather them there and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name." You see, Nehemiah realizes that it is God's faithfulness to his word that offers hope. God was faithful to his word in sending them into captivity, but God has promised to bring them back if they confess their sins and obey his commandments. You see, God's actions are based on faithfulness to his word. And recognition of his faithfulness leads man to faith. Nehemiah was not only a man of prayer, but he was a man of faith. And his faith was based on the very character of God. And so he says in verse 10, "Now these are thy servants and thy people whom thou hast redeemed with thy great power and by thy strong hand." He said, "Here we are, God. We're ready to obey your word, confessing sin. And we want to see what you have promised come to pass." And he has the faith to pray and remind God of this portion of Scripture because he knows that God will be faithful to his word if they do their part. You see, the man of prayer realizes that it is God who is in control of everything. He is in control. And prayer brings about God's response, his intervention. In 1940, the Germans were pushing close to 500,000 French and English troops straight into the English Channel. They were retreating to a place called Dunkirk. An English general wrote in his diary prior to the events of Dunkirk, these words: "It will take a miracle to save us now." The English estimated that of this nearly 500,000 troops, that they would be lucky to save 30 to 40,000, less than 10%. Then some strange things begin to happen. Suddenly, Hitler called off his tanks, wanting instead to direct them toward Paris. The Nazis themselves had bombed oil refineries nearby, and a sudden change in the wind pushed the black smoke over the beaches at Dunkirk. By the time that had dissipated, a heavy fog had settled in. The Germans were helpless to do anything through the air. The English had called out civilian crafts of all kind because they did not have enough military vessels to evacuate the troops. All little ragtag fleet of fishing vessels and small pleasure crafts streamed toward Dunkirk. Normally, many of them would have sank because of the rough seas and the rocks. But for some reason, the English Channel was as calm as a farm pond. Instead of only saving 30 or 40,000, 338,000 troops were evacuated to England. And it is no coincidence that just prior to those events, that King George VI of England proclaimed a national day of fasting and prayer to God. God is in control. The leader must recognize that. That's why he must be a man of prayer. He must be a man of prayer because problems are too great for man alone to solve. Because of man's sin, he must be a man of prayer, confessing sin and dealing with sin in the lives of people. And he must be a man of prayer because it is God that is in control of everything and every event and every happening in this world. Ted Turner, the owner of Cable News Network and TBS and the Atlanta Braves, and used to be the Atlanta Hawks, the man known as the Mouth of the South, has upon his desk a little motto that I have seen in the papers and in books and heard people refer to it many times. It says this: lead, follow, or get out of the way. That's his motto. Some indeed do get in the way. Some people hinder. And some people are followers, and rightfully so, they should be. But the whole focus of what I'm trying to say today and the days ahead is this: some people should lead. Some people must lead. God's church, the Christian home, indeed our very society, our nation, cannot survive unless people lead. And I will have to admit to you this morning that it is my feeling that we have far, far too few leaders. Not just in the world, but also in our homes, and particularly so in our churches, and even more particularly so in this church. Now, if you're already in a position of leadership, a teacher, a deacon, an officer, whatever, if you're in a position of leadership, then lead. Say, how do I lead? We're going to talk about that more as we go on in this series. But suffice it to say now that you can never lead until you first of all become a person of prayer. Some must lead. If God is calling you to lead, then lead. And begin with prayer. Make prayer a vital part of your life. If you, as the head of your home, or as a wife who is a leader in the home, realize that you're failing miserably to be a God-appointed leader that God meant you to be in that home, then confess sin and lead. Become spiritually what your family needs from you. And if I may address those that are here this morning that may not be Christians, let me just say this. Let me emphasize it again. Problems are the result of sin. But remember, God is in control, and God has the answer for sin and for your problems. Jesus Christ died on Calvary's cross for your sin. If you will admit it and turn to Him and place your trust in Him and commit your life to Him today, He will save you from your sin, and He will become the answer to your problems.